Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here, a film talk show here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available as a podcast, and it's also available on iTunes. Joining me in studio, Glenn Dobbs, the founder of the feast that is known as Indie Bard Fest, which is happening October 17th through to 27th at the District Theater, as well as Indie 11 and the Fringe Theater. You can go to IndieBardFest.com for all the information. Full disclosure, I'm working with this man. So we'll be talking a little bit about Bard Fest. We might get into a little stage sociology, which has never happened before here.
Oh, no, never.
Never, but we will do it again. Hi, Glenn.
Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. And by the way, thank you to everybody who supported WFYI and all the shows here at WFYI as a part of our fall membership drive. And thank you for supporting public radio goodness. And just a reminder, it's never too late or too early to donate to WFYI. So you can go to WFYI.org/give to show your support. So thank you for that. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, these are first world film critic problems, especially in my case. Because I am currently in rehearsal for the Indie Bard Fest production of Henry IV, Part 1, my evenings are shot. They are occupied. So the only time I can see new movies is if either A, they are mailed to me or streamed to me, or I go to a... I have a quizzical look from Glenn. Yes, films are sent to me sometimes. I have to send them back.
Just working through Stream to you. That's
what
I'm
fine.
Through, yes.
I once felt like you, and now it's just a part of the existence. But I'm still pro physical copy. I'm sure I'll rant about that as I do every week. So if I don't get an email or a physical screener or a streaming screener or an online screener, then quite often I will go on Friday morning, 10 or 11 o'clock at your favorite local multiplex with a lovely group I like to call the old, the unemployed, and the weird.
And the retired.
Because you can pick which other category you're in. So, but those are the people that are at a multiplex at 11 o'clock on a Friday. Well, because of Pledge Drive, I was stuck here at work. So if you are looking for my opinions on the biopic or biopic of Judy, you're just going to have to find another show. So you could go to actually the Midwest Film Journal or the Film Yap, and you can read my colleagues' reviews of Renee Zellweger as Judy elsewhere.
I've seen two different reviews on that and an interview with her. It sounds intriguing. Some people, at least in the interviews that I saw, very praise-oriented. They think she's fantastic, and other people think it's more of a caricature of the part.
Well, that's going to be the fascinating part, and I like the fact that we've, biopics are cinematic comfort food, and music biopics are especially cinematic comfort food as we speak now. So, yeah, I will be intrigued to see how that goes. I think that's one that probably the Socies will see as a trio. So, anyway, we will get to that sometime. But I guess since Glenn, you are my guest and I am the host, is there anything recent that you were able to see? Because you don't have enough going on directing two shows, marketing a festival, dealing with a host who's also a fat man from time to time.
You're not. No, I've seen three shows, not all back to back, but I really enjoy Marvel movies, so I saw this new Spider-Man movie.
Yes, and now he is back in the fold, as was reported at the time of this recording. So,
Would you please enlighten me? Because I've been doing stage stuff. What's going on?
Well, hold on a second. I believe, and by the way, folks, this is what you get your pledge dollars at work. Hot clicking action here at WFYI. Sony and Marvel strike a deal to co-produce a third Spider-Man film.
Oh, well.
So there was a little bit of contention, and as you know, I believe if you're a longtime listener, there was some contention between Sony and Marvel. And of course, the Socies were more than happy to offer our guest room to Aunt May. But I don't think that's going to be needed now. Mrs. Socie is relieved, I'm sure.
Well, since you were all things to film, the other thing I saw in the news today is Kevin Feige, the producer of everything, Marvel, is now going to make a Star Wars movie.
Okay.
Did you see that?
No.
It was a headline, a Hollywood Reporter. He is going to come in, and I don't know about taking over Star Wars, but he's going to produce the next Star Wars movie.
Okay. Well,
I mean, that man has enough on his plate.
There is. So, and same, you know, why? Same reason why dogs lick their elbows.
Because they can. Yes.
So yeah. No, so anyway, there is that. But that's way down the pipe. I generally here on the show, I'm generally not a what's in development type person because until I see a poster or a trailer, I don't care.
Okay.
It's fine. I don't mean to belittle your bringing of information.
I'm just making notes for rehearsal.
No. Okay, it started over 20 years ago when two dear friends of mine, who also happen to be basement dwellers, almost came to fisticuffs because one was convinced that Kenneth Branagh was going to play young Obi-Wan in the prequels.
Oh, I've actually heard this, that, too.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I have more important things to do on that. So, and, you know, the Freddy versus Jason development had been talked for years. The Alien versus Predator stuff had been talked about for years.
They actually did that.
Yeah, eventually. But I was like, and now I'm like, well, until, and of course, with the problems with the films of Terry Gilliam, I used to be, until I see a poster or a trailer, I don't care. And it's now, once I sit in a theater and the theater goes dark, then I'll believe it.
I forgot to mention that. I saw the Don Quixote film.
Did you?
I did.
Did you? And what did you think?
I think if it was made 15, 20 years ago, it would have been
a bigger
Oscar and people would talk about the cinematography, but it was just a little bit of a strange film. I mean, what were your thoughts?
I have not seen it yet, and I have championed the death of Don Quixote for a long, long time.
Yeah. The man who killed
him. I'm sorry, the man who yeah. I know they changed. I think they changed that. Anyway,
yeah.
But the second play I ever directed here in town, it was I did an adaptation of the Euripides Greek tragedy Medea with the brilliant Jolene Mentink-Moffat as my lead. And while we were in rehearsal for that was when the documentary Lost in La Mancha came out. Mm. And I was so enthralled with the film and inspired because I thought, well, if Terry Gilliam has this much trouble with a $25 million film and doesn't finish it, my little $140 play can soar. So, I have to look and see if it's still streaming because
I got it off Netflix, but it came as a CD. But it does have a cute little opening title that says, A Film 23 Years in the Making.
He's fully aware of his issues and problems and obstacles. As Terry Gilliam is almost at times becoming this generation's Orson Welles when it comes to famous for stuff he has finished or hasn't finished. Right. So, no, I think I will eventually get to that. I assure you. But I'm glad you saw that.
Yeah, I did.
But you know what's funny? Because that same criticism you had, I had the same way about his Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Hmm. I wish, because originally, this is another thing. Originally it was supposed to be this, and now it's that. Mm-hmm. Alex Cox, the man who gave us Sid and Nancy, and Walker, was supposed to have directed it. I would have loved to have seen it done in the Just Say No 80s instead of the time it came out. I mean, Johnny Depp and Benicio del Toro were fine, and the film is trippy because it's Terry Gilliam. Mm-hmm. I just wish it had been done a little earlier.
Well, as I was reading about, because I'd heard so much about the problems with making the movie, I read a little bit about it, and I guess Johnny Depp was originally supposed to be in the movie, and they actually started making it, and then they pulled the funding on it. And then Adam Driver's in it, who I think is a a very good actor.
Mishawaka's own Adam Driver.
Oh, he's very good. Yeah. He's fantastic. And it was well done. It was filmed in Spain. And then mm-hmm. Jonathan Pryce, who's one of those actors who you can just watch breathe. He just is so good.
Yep.
He's the Don Quixote character. And it's wonderful. It's a wonderful... But it's kind of like one of those things, like when you went to college and went to see an art house movie, it kind of has that vibe to it.
Well, it's, and I wonder. Yeah, I will check that. I would like to see that. No, definitely. So
I'm so happy. I got to recommend the movie to you.
You know what? It happens. Believe it or not, I know with the status that I have
as a legend.
Stop. That's with a lowercase L, folks. I give off the aura that I've seen everything. I have not. And especially with my program, I've now gotten to a point where I'm going to pick and choose what I want to see.
Absolutely. So,
because I don't know how many folks really want my input on the latest Child's Play, which I think is now out on Blu-ray. We'll get to the video titles in just a second. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here at WFYI.org. So the big title that came out on video this week is Yesterday.
I've not seen that.
Okay. I've said a few times already, and now granted I did enjoy Blinded by the Light more than I thought I would. Of course, John Katzenberger and I talked about that ad nauseum a while back, and I'm now an old man where I say, please stop making movies about my record collection.
Yeah.
You've been pretty good so far. My fear is that one's just gonna, crap the bed, and I'm gonna be angry about it. So, and Yesterday is a fine, harmless fairy tale. I wish, and I know it was Danny Boyle directed it, and I wish that John Carney, the man who gave us Once and Sing Street and Begin Again, I wish he had done it. Mm-hmm. It would have been, I think, a little meatier and a little more of a challenge as far as dealing with the music of the Beatles. And I think this was very surface stuff.
Okay.
So that is out there. Glenn, I told Glenn, because he's also been in rehearsal at night. I have seen him that, we haven't been able to see anything new. And there was Yesterday and there was Anna, the latest Luc Besson female action film, which I didn't see either. But the other film of note that came out this week in the new titles, and you saw it, and I didn't ask you to see it. You
yes,
saw it, but
you did.
I mentioned that Shaft is out on video, and you watched that one.
Well, I watched that
I'm
one.
I'm really
and one
sorry.
Other, one other one. You know, the thing about it, it was interesting to watch. I was talking with my wife about it this morning. If this was like the early 80s or late 70s, it fits into the same genre of a Clint Eastwood movie, a Burt Reynolds movie.
Sure.
You have Samuel Jackson, who is a character type, and he's going to go and beat everybody up and say all the cute lines at the right thing. The problem with it is it's incredibly dated. It has misogynistic and just awful lines throughout. It's not even very well written. They could have done a Shaft of like Shaft being an old dinosaur and
Richard Roundtree shows up.
Yes, at the end, and he's carrying a bazooka.
Yeah, that's why.
And then the kid that's supposed to be
the son.
Yeah, I'm the nerdy son. I'm not really Shaft. And it turns out he knows kung fu and everything else in the world. And it gets even worse. He pulls out a little gun and starts shooting everybody up, and his would-be girlfriend goes, "Oh, you're just such a man." And it's just dumb.
It is selective in its tone because one scene, the kid is kind of a klutz.
Yeah.
And then another scene, he's straight out of
Do you know where
film.
He's from?
Location?
No, I mean, have you recognized the kid where he's from? He's from what I thought was a marvelous series on Amazon called The Boys.
I've never seen it.
I highly recommend it. Would be worth a whole show for you to see. It takes the superhero genre.
Yeah, Carl Urban's in it. I know.
It turns it on its head, mm-hmm. and it's wildly entertaining because it's just so weird, and it was just epic in its scope.
Okay.
It's very, very gory. The Superman character's heat ray vision just disembowels people with it. It's that kind of gory.
Emboweled?
Not emboweled. Not your line from the play.
Thank you. See, I'm trying.
You are memorizing well. This is a good time to try that.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, but he's from that. He's the Flash character in that, and he's very good in that, but this one's dumb.
I took Emma to see Shaft. Now, I love the original Shaft films, all three, which, by the way, I believe Warner Brothers has put them out on Blu-ray now, so I appreciate that. The Shaft remake that was done with Samuel L. Jackson, directed by John Singleton in the aughts, was okay. And this one, and this was another generational thing, taking my 17-year-old, because she had never seen any of the Shaft films. I asked her if she wanted to tag along. She said sure. And what I've got out of it, and especially if you see the trailers for this, it feels like Ride Along. It feels like a Kevin Hart film, except this kid is cheaper than Kevin Hart.
It's not funny.
And, not that funny. And Fall Down, Go Boom. So the tone of it, it's an awkward buddy cop film when it should be a detective story.
It's not even very funny.
No, it's not. But the thing was, my daughter liked it because she hasn't seen that many detective films, buddy cop films,
that sort of thing. It's hard not to like Samuel Jackson because he's just such an iconic character.
Yeah, but he gets paid to be Samuel L. Jackson, right, which is not very challenging.
No.
All you have to do is show up.
No. Well, the same thing as, a Clint Eastwood or anybody else.
Right. There's people that are paid to be their persona. We understand that.
Right.
So now I was able to, that night, show her highlights of the original Gordon Parks Shaft film from 1971. So that, at the very least, I got that. But, no, I didn't ask for this.
But one of the things I do get, and I did appreciate, was, if I was African American, and then to see the hero be African American and not the sidekick, and the hero,
That was the whole '70s era.
That
right.
was great, and I totally get that, and I understand it totally. It's the same thing going back to Marvel with Black Panther.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same kind of thing, except Black Panther was an infinitely better movie and was basically Hamlet light. By the way, Shakespeare in this?
Yeah, I said when it first came out, it is the most Shakespearean of the Marvel films since the first Thor.
Yeah, that's true.
Because there's crown, there is a throne, there is jealousy, there is daddy issues and sibling issues and a past and all that. So, no, I get that. I do get that. So, anyway, speaking of which, of course, a lot of the home video companies and everything, they kind of repackage stuff and resell them. I don't know if this is out on Blu-ray for the first time or not. But I'm going to bring it up anyway, and it's from Warner Archives. But if you need 1988's Action Jackson with Carl Weathers on Blu-ray, saw this in the theater. I was a senior in high school. There was a brief period where Carl Weathers, post-Apollo Creed, got to star in some B-level action movies.
Yeah.
This one is beer and pizza personified. More fun than the Shaft film we just talked about.
Much more fun.
You have Vanity, Sharon Stone, Craig T. Nelson really chewing scenery. There's a ridiculous action scene with him driving a sports car up a flight of stairs.
Is Craig T. Nelson still alive?
Yeah, he's still with us.
Okay.
Yeah, he's still out and about. Remember, he did the Incredibles film last year.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah. So, right. This is beer and pizza night. So it's now out on Blu-ray. If you need the clarity and sound of Action Jackson to be pristine, there you go.
So that
is out there. That's a lot of fun. Criterion has two titles out. One I need to watch sometime because I don't think I've seen this. From 1928, the Charlie Chaplin film, The Circus.
Mm.
So that is one I believe I've missed. And Criterion's been really, really good about doing the Chaplin films and doing a lot of goodies on that. This week, ladies and gentlemen, one of the film sociology rants can now finally be retired. There's a lot of them, but this one I'm happy to say is it has finally happened. I had nothing to do with this happening, but it finally happened. The Criterion Collection has finally put out on DVD and Blu-ray the 1983 comedy Local Hero.
Oh, yeah.
I love this film. And this is a longtime IFJA member and longtime film critic and longtime film sociology guest, Ed Johnsonat, of course, of Nouveau fame. This is his favorite film of all time, and I thought that's a heck of a choice to have. I saw this in the theater when I was 13, and it was a game changer mm-hmm. for me. Bill Forsythe, and this was also Bill Forsythe was a man who directed this, and this opened the gateway for Scottish cinema in the U.S. It stars Peter Riegert of Animal House fame as a corporate man who works for a major corporation, an oil company in Texas. He is sent by his boss, played by Burt Lancaster, to go to the small Scottish coastal town and basically buy the town mm-hmm. so they can build an oil refinery. And Peter Capaldi, for you fans of Doctor Who or The Thick of It, is his liaison, and he is sent to this was my first encounter, and I believe the first encounter or the first creation that I can remember of the quaint, charming little UK cinema town where everybody is fascinating and everybody's lovely, and you want to move there. And what happens is. The local townies are a little smarter than you think they are, mixed in with Riegert's character, who's, you know, got a Porsche and's got the high rise in Houston, and he falls in love with the town and the lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And I was 13 when this film came out, and this along with Bruce Beresford's Tender Mercies were my concept to the idea, to my introduction to the concept of less is more. Mm. Which every teenage boy should go through if they have not already. Just a funny film. It's not a knee slapper, but it's a charming, lovely little picture. Yeah. Great music by Mark Knopfler, and you know there was that weird thing because after Animal House, anytime you got to see anybody from those films, especially the secondary, but the non Belushi characters show up in something, that was a cause to celebrate. Yeah. And Riegert's great in this. So it is finally out on Criterion. Please go experience this film. And now, Criterion, I will retire that from being finally put on the catalog. Now put Tender Mercies in the Criterion catalog, if you would. So
you know, it reminds me of, it's not as good of a movie, but there was a Hugh Grant picture called The Englishman.
The who went up a hill and came down a mountain.
Yeah, same kind
Waking
of charming.
Ned Divine.
Charming little
yeah,
English town.
Everybody.
It's like the whole thing is a walking Bill Bryson novel.
Exactly.
You know, with it. Yeah.
When we were in Scotland, I climbed the highest point in Edinburgh, and I thought it was a mountain, and the guys at the liquor store said it was a hill. And I said, shut up. Is Tara Fitzgerald waiting for me? Because I would like that. Anyway, that is fine. Finally out on home video. So kudos to Criterion for doing that. Well, we're putting a curtain speech. Turn off your electronics. So anyway, those are the big titles that are coming out on home video. Now, down to IU Cinema, depending on when you're listening to this and how fast it gets out there, at 10 o'clock on Friday, September 27th, the 20th anniversary screening of But I'm a Cheerleader. Friday. Saturday, September 29th at 1 o'clock from 1931, Working Girls, not the 88 film with Melanie Griffith. At 4 o'clock on the 29th from 2019 as a part of the International Art House Series and running the screen, films directed by women. 4 o'clock, the film Clemency. Monday, September 30th, at 7 o'clock, the Sarah Polley documentary, Stories We Tell. A documentary that has a bit of a Rashomon to it. Thursday, October 3rd at 7 o'clock, Ellie Sachs and Matt Starr will be present for their 2018 film, My Annie Hall. Friday, October 4th at 7 o'clock is the Spiritual Avant-Garde. As a part of the Underground Film Series. And then Friday, October 4th at 10 p.m., programmed by IU Cinema social media specialist and marketing engagement assistant Caitlin Stevens, Mad Max Fury Road.
Oh, I
on
love
a
that
big
movie.
Screen. You got to see that.
It's a great movie.
And you mentioned Black Panther, Saturday, October 5th at 3 o'clock. And costume designer Ruth E. Carter is scheduled to be present. So a good reason to head down to IU Cinema. And I heard Ruthie Carter is also did the costumes for Dolomite Is My Name, the biopic with Eddie Murphy playing Rudy Ray Moore and the creation of the Dolomite character. So
have you seen that picture?
I have not seen that yet. I'm looking very forward to it because I own a lot of Rudy Ray Moore's films in my collection.
Sure.
That's happening at IU Cinema at the Historic Art Crafts Cinema. on Saturday, the 28th, at 2 and 7:30 p.m., a 35-millimeter print of Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban from 2004. Friday, October 4th at 7:30 p.m., Ghost. Saturday, October 5th at 7:30 p.m., The Lost Boys. And Friday the 13th is playing on October 11th and 12th, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Friday and Saturday, October 11th and 12th. All of those at the Historic Art Craft Theater. We head over to the Tibbs Drive-In. Glenn, the last time you were at a drive-in movie?
A Godzilla movie.
Not the 98 one.
No, it was Destroy All Monsters.
Really?
Yeah.
That far back?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so I've got to get an in there. So here we go at the Tibbs. So I'm always intrigued with the pairings. Are they the same studio? Is it the same genre? What's going on? At the Tibbs Drive-In on screen one, Abominable, which opened this weekend, and Hobbs and Shaw, because you don't have enough Fast and Furious films. Screen two, Rambo Last Blood.
Moving on.
And Angel Has Fallen. Okay. Screen three, Hustlers, followed by It, Chapter 2. Okay. And then screen four, Ad Astra and The Lion King. Okay. Those are at the Tibbs. Over at the Skyline Drive-In, Rambo and Ready or Not. There you go. That's happening that weekend over there. And just a reminder, at the Keystone Art Cinemas for October, it is coming up very soon, their Midnight Movie Series. Glenn, have you done a Midnight Movie before?
A Marvel movie. I went to Midnight.
Oh, like the night before kind of thing?
Yeah.
Okay, very good.
Yeah.
Midnight movies are a lost art because of home video, and you can see things when you want, but there's still the communal experience of seeing it with a group of people. And the fact that Keystone Art does midnight movies in the summer and the fall is always cool. October 4th and 5th, The Lost Boys. Mm-hmm. October 18th and 19th, the original Tobey Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre. October 25th and 26th, John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness. That's one I don't think I've seen it since it came out, and I was in high school at the time. And then November 8th and 9th, yes, and he will be there both nights, Tommy Wiseau and The Room.
He's coming to town?
He is coming to town.
Oh, there you go.
Which means I'll be playing my famous interview with him the week before that on here on Film Sociology. So those are out there. Now, as far as there's a couple other movie titles that came out on video recently that I am catching up on, so I will share them with you, both as a part of the Indie Pix Unlimited and Prime Video channels. This is from a French film from 2012 called The Whirlpool, and it's two Parisian strangers who meet at Niagara Falls. And a man and woman, and things start to escalate very quickly for them. They love, they joke, they argue, they travel. And for the most part, the film is good. It's also less than 80 minutes, which is really helpful. It does, because you're spending most of the time with these two people, and are they stable enough, or are you tolerant enough to spend this much emotional time with these two characters? And for the most part, they pull it off. I think if it went longer, it would get a little tiresome.
Yeah.
But the film does have that kind of late 60s, early 70s art house feel, when all you need is a camera and two people, and you create some chemistry. So The Whirlpool is out on video, as well as the Chinese film from 2018 called Intimacy, which is a little longer, and I could have used this to be a little shorter, but what happens when two people almost meet physically after they've been connecting online for quite a while? Mm. So you have his world, her world. He's just moved to Shanghai after working at his mom's shop, and he's trying to break out and make a name for himself. She is stuck at home. Dad is taking care of her, going to clubs, not finding the best guys, and it's a build up that is not hitting you over the head at the end. Mm-hmm. It just happens, which kind of helps helps make this film a little easier to swallow. But the fact is you have two. You know what? It's Abdul and I. Because we only have one line exchange in Henry IV. But don't go expecting a vaudeville show if you go see Henry the Fourth Part One, because he's in scenes and I'm in scenes. We're just not in them together. But anyway, intimacy is pretty good on that part there. Now, from yes,
let
sir.
Let me ask you.
Yeah.
I'm noticing what you can't see on the radio is that Matt's showing off his DVD collection.
I have to. This is what I do to remind myself to talk about these on the show.
Do you collect all of these movies?
Yes.
So what kind of library are we talking about?
That's materialistic. I would never keep count.
10,000?
I don't.
How do you keep them organized?
Alphabetically.
Okay.
Thank you, Dewey. Decimal.
You're welcome. I actually know what that is.
So no. So I am still of the type that unless you physically own it, you don't really own it.
Now, did you get into LaserDisc for a while?
No. I've been very good about that. I think I have about 20 VHS tapes that nobody has found the rights to make these into DVD or Blu-ray. Yeah, I do have a Blu-ray player, and
I should bring these in to you because I have the original Star Wars, not the modified version.
Oh, the Han shot first versions.
Yeah,
good. Yeah, I like that.
But I don't have any way to play because I don't have a VHS player anymore.
Ah, okay. So yeah, I'm kind of that. I think my fear is I'm going to turn into Burgess Meredith on the Twilight Zone. I just got to make sure I don't go blind and deaf. So yeah. So anyway, that's kind of where I'm at there. But Mill Creek Entertainment has put out some older titles of films, and I remember this coming out, and this is about as good as an example of a popcorn movie as one can find. And what I mean by that is it's not Best Picture, it's not the best thing ever, it's not the worst thing ever. It is a very well-done film to keep your mind off things for a couple hours. I remember taking Miss Associate to this when it came out. The heist comedy Duplicity with Julia Roberts and Owen Clive Owen, as they say, she's an ex-CIA agent, he's an ex-MI6, and you find out early on how they met, and they fall in love, and we're not sure if they really trust each other, but they're going to team up to bilk two rival companies that have been fighting each other for a secret formula.
I saw that movie.
And it's written and directed by Tony Gilroy, who gave us the Oscar-nominated film Michael Clayton, the George Clooney picture. You also have Paul Giamatti and Tom Wilkinson coming off the bench as the rival company CEOs. That's not bad company. But it's a lot of fun watching these two work together, Julia and Clive. They had previously worked together on the film version of Closer, of course. This is a sunnier picture by comparison. What Duplicity does is, and this is one where, folks, you have to pay attention, even though it's on home video, it goes back and forth in time. It's a nonlinear story of how they met and what they're going to do to bilk these two companies. But it's a light, breezy film that's just really well done. Beautiful locations and beautiful people and funny CEOs fighting in airports. So, yeah, that is finally out on, and I think this is the first time it comes out on Blu-ray. So
cool.
There is that. Also out on Blu-ray, and I mentioned this because, as he said, I have visual aids to remind myself to talk about these. But Mill Creek Entertainment has been doing a series of video releases and packaging them so they look like VHS boxes. From 1989, the courtroom drama True Believer with James Woods and Robert Downey Jr. Woods plays a former 60s radical lawyer who is now, by the late 80s, making a living defending drug dealers. And it's more not so much defending them, but attacking the U.S. Constitution.
Complete opposite of what he is now.
Right. He has become a shell of what have you.
Yeah.
Robert Downey Jr., who doesn't have a whole lot to do in this film. He plays a plucky young law student grad who wants to work with his idol, and guess what? Never meet your idols. And in this case, a fire gets into Woods' belly again when a Korean man has been sent to jail for accused of murder of a drug kingpin, a gang shooting, and did he actually do it or not? So Other than Woods grandstanding a little bit, which I know my lawyer friends would say he would get tossed out of court immediately, reputation or not, it is a showcase for James Woods. Mm-hmm. And this is the less we talk about James Woods on Twitter, the better. but he, you know, in his when it's a good project, he's always fascinating to watch.
True.
This is, you know, 3 years after Salvador. Mm-hmm. And but no, a pretty decent popcorn courtroom drama. So
sure.
That is out on video.
Cool.
All right. I want to get to Dead People We Like because we never have time for Dead People We Don't Like, as we say on this show. We raise a glass and say farewell to actor Sid Haig. Now, Sid Haig died at the age of 80 on September 21st. His credits go all the way back to 1960. And if you're a cult movie fan, you know Haig. Most recently, probably best known in this generation as Captain Spaulding from the Rob Zombie films, like House of a Thousand Corpses, Devil's Rejects, Three from Hell, which came out earlier this year. I know him going all the way back to Beach Ball from 1965, Bloodbath from 1966, where he's Abdul the Arab. There's a text from our co-star in 3, 2, 1. Plays Daddy in It's a Bikini World from 1967. I have a weird fascination with late 60s beach movies, and this one's not that good, but Sid Haig is pretty good. He is the guy who doesn't wear a bathing suit in the beach movie. That's Sid Haig. No,
oh.
he wears clothes, Glenn. Sorry.
Oh, I see. I was wondering what kind of movies you went to see.
No. It's like if it were a Baywatch thing, he's the guy wearing a shirt.
Well, so the Frankie Avalon T-shirt you're wearing right now has nothing to do with it.
Very good. Yeah. But he was one of those that would star and have larger roles in smaller pictures, and eventually show up in some in small roles in bigger pictures. For instance, he's a guard in the John Borman near masterpiece Point Blank from 1967. Played Ralph in the midnight movie favorite Spider Baby, or The Maddest Story Ever Told. If you've not seen Spider Baby, look for it. It's it's delightfully twisted. Played Antonio in 1969's biopic of Che. Plays one of the bikers in the Joan Namath film CC and Company. Yes, the biker movie with Joan Namath and Anne Margaret. Did a lot of television, appeared in episodes of Death Valley Days, Get Smart, Gunsmoke, Mission Impossible, Alias Smith and Jones. Also appeared in THX 1138. Mm. Thing I know him from were the women in prison movies that were shot in the Philippines, like The Big Dollhouse, The Big Birdcage. Why are you shaking your head? These films happened, and they had Pam Grier in them. Played the slumber ink attendant in 1971's Diamonds Are Forever. So, yes, he was in a Bond film. Was in Beware the Blob from 1972. Black Mama, White Mama with Pam Grier. It is a female version of The Defiant Ones.
Oh, yes, that's right.
Two women linked together. One's black and the other's white. And it's these prison movies that were shot in the Philippines. You should look those up.
Yeah.
Wonder Woman from 1973. He was Omar in Pam Grier's Coffee, 1973. Labeled as the Arab, or Arab, in The Don is Dead from 1973. Busting from 74. Played Hayes in Foxy Brown, 1974. Was also in Savage Sisters, 1974. Bald Pirate in Swashbuckler, the Robert Shaw film from 1976. Galaxy of Terror from 1981. In between then, appearing in episodes of Mary Hartman, Jason of Star Command, Choo Choo and the Philly Flash, ooh. The Fall Guy. You know, one of these guys, always constantly working. Was in one of the two competing Lombada films from 1990, The Forbidden Dance. He appeared in that. The other part, it was a nice little homage to his career, and he kind of took some time off from acting, and Quentin Tarantino brought him back for one scene to play the judge in Jackie Brown. Mm. So for serious movie nerds, it was fun to see Pam Grier and Sid Haig in a film together. And then his between that, getting that notice, and then his career was rejuvenated in 2003, playing Captain Spaulding in Rob Zombie's House of a Thousand Corpses, which led to Kill Bill Volume 2, The Devil's Rejects, the Rob Zombie remake of Halloween, Lords of Salem, Bone Tomahawk, a really grisly and underrated Western from 2015 with Kurt Russell. And as I mentioned, Three from Hell came out earlier this year, directed by Rob Zombie. So thanks, Sid. I got to have a couple of minutes with Sid at the Horror Hound convention. You know, the ones that are always on the near west side by the airport or the hotel near the airport. And, you know, just I gave him a card, tried to get him on the show. It didn't happen, but got a couple of minutes with him. And, you know, was one of those that if when he wasn't working could go and have praise heaped upon him in the horror convention circuit.
Sure.
So cool for him on that. The other thing that happened this week, when I had a night off from rehearsal, thank you, Glenn.
You're welcome.
And actually, thanks, Matt Anderson. My daughter was sick earlier this week, and so as a part to get some dad-daughter time, because my wife and daughter are working on a separate production, so the fact that all three of us are together, that's a big deal. And this is her second time seeing the film. She requested this, and I'm happy to say that my daughter's tastes run the gamut from Shakespeare to Bachelor Party. So, yes, I have shown my daughter Bachelor Party, the Tom Hanks slob versus snobs comedies set in 1984. The horny teenager movies of the 70s, you know, your Animal House and Hollywood Nights, and then went into the early 80s with Porky's and and those others. Not really in my daughter's wheelhouse. But to see young Tom Hanks, and this really, while watching this, this is a film that is, I don't know, I'm not going to say if it's aged well or not. It's aged better than, say, Revenge of the Nerds. Mm-hmm. But, and, you know, it's a rowdy little R-rated comedy about bachelor parties and the things that are supposed to happen at bachelor parties, girls and drugs and mules who ingest such things, and you know, hygiene, you know, pranks, and these are not horny teenagers; these are horny 20-somethings. But the film is anchored by a really nice performance from Tom Hanks. He is not a bag. He is not a jerk. The whole one of the elements of the story is his fiance, played by 80s icon Tawny Kitaen, you know, doesn't want him screwing around on the bachelor party, and he keeps to his word. Mm-hmm. They're a lesser character, a lesser actor, and a lesser film. He would have gone down that route, mm-hmm. but still get married. It wasn't the fact. This film doesn't. Is the climax is not will they or won't they get married? It's will he or won't he stay committed?
Yeah.
On top of the nudity and drugs and nonsense that goes on. So I would say of these slob, horny slob comedies of the late 70s, early 80s, this is right up there with the Hollywood Nights, but I have a soft spot for the Hollywood Nights. So
sure.
There you go. All right. Before I dip into Glenn's film history, once again, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. Indie Bard Fest, which is happening October 17th through the 27th at the District Theater on Mass Ave, used to be Theater on the Square, as well as the Indy 11 and the Fringe.
Basile,
I'm sorry, the mm-hmm. Basile. So you can go to IndieBardFest.com for all the information and the shows. We have Henry the Fourth Part 1, Hamlet, a youth production of Midsummer Night's Dream. The Tempest.
The Tempest, right.
Sorry. And Lear Shadow.
That's a very special show. Lear Shadow was a feature film. You can find it on iTunes if you look for it.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
It won some awards. It's a great story of how we got this script. It's from a playhouse in Pasadena. Mm-hmm. And they had premiered it at their location to quite good reviews. And when we had to reschedule one of our regular productions, I had a copy of this with an eye toward perhaps producing it for 2020 or 2021. I couldn't find the script, so I finally got a hold of the Playhouse. They answered me and said, sure, we'll send you the script.
Okay.
And it It's just this gorgeous, astonishing play that's set in contemporary Los Angeles that weaves in both.
Go
on. That weaves in both a very compelling story with a very unusual twist, and then some of the works of King Lear as it weaves it through. It features three of the best actors in town. It just blisteringly goes along at a fantastic pace. And we are really lucky to be the regional premiere of this show in all of the United States.
Excellent.
So it's very exciting. And so I encourage people to check it out. It will change you. It's a transformative play, and it will change you in a very positive way of just seeing how human beings go through a trial.
Okay,
yeah,
so that's
it's beautiful.
That is there, and then of course Hamlet. That's the guy who can't decide anything.
Right, can't make up his mind.
And then there's the Tempest. There's monsters and islands and fairies and
dads. The thing about the Tempest.
I'm kidding.
No. But the thing that's interesting about the Tempest, even though we call it a youth production,
It's because it's done by youths.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But it's a full fledged production. It's not dumbed down.
No,
it's not abbreviated. It's directed by Dr. Kathy Phipps from Agape. It is just lovely, luscious, beautiful show, and I think it's going to probably be one of our best sellers this year. So we're very excited to have it.
Yes, and then there's Henry IV.
Yeah,
part one,
because no one likes part two.
an actual line from this show.
Yeah, exactly. The Henry IV part one is the perfect play. It's perfect because it has everything in it. We have screwball comedy. We have inspirational speeches. We have father-son issues. We have gorgeous music. We have, I think, six hugely detailed sword fights. It all runs by in a rollicking 2 hours. It is just plain fun. The only problem we have is we're struggling with one of the leads, a young
I'm
guy.
I'm sitting right here. I can hear you.
Falstaff, and we had to struggle to do that, but he's not too bad. He's coming along. Yeah,
that's me, folks.
Yeah. In all honesty, Matt Soucy has graced us with coming in and being able to do this show.
Well, I guess
and he has done. I'm going to get this out here because I want people to hear it. You all won't toot your own horn. This young man is a phenomenal actor with Falstaff is not an easy role. Falstaff has layers upon layers of complexity, and he is widely considered one of Shakespeare's greatest inventions. It is a bucket list role for any actor to get a chance to do this. And Mr. Soucy steps into the very big pants of Falstaff. And we had to use some prosthetics with him because he's just too skinny for Falstaff.
Thank you. You're making me blush now. Yeah, when I found out I was going to be padded for this is the first. I did not have to De Niro myself all summer. And there. If you look on the interweb, and I don't recommend that. It looks like the Michelin Man in Altered States. So.
He does do a nice job, but he does just brilliant work, brilliant comedy. It's worth going. The bar scene alone is worth going to the whole play.
I do enjoy the bar scene.
It is just amazing, and so I can't encourage people enough. So as Matt has said, we try to make it simple for people to want to come to what we feel is the fall's biggest theater event. We want them to come, and the way to find out about it is to go to indiebardfest.com, and it's all one word, IndyBardFest.com. And there you'll see photos, pictures, information, schedules, and tell your friends to come because you will not want to see. I mean, you will not want to see.
Thanks, Dr. Freud.
No, you will not want to miss Mr. Soucy as he takes on this amazing role.
And I should also mention the other one of my other radio partners in crime, Abdul-Hakim Shabazz, is playing King Henry.
And he does it such a shy and demure manner. Yeah, because Abdul has to, the thing about Abdul is he just is so in his shell. It's so hard to get him to speak up about things that we really struggle with that. But once he comes out of his shell, he's a rather extraordinary actor.
There you go. Yeah. So, yeah, I guess going back.
I'm waiting for a text from Abdul for
in
that.
In 3, 2, 1. Now, when did, I guess, how do you pick out? I mean, so it's, I know we know it's four different groups,
right?
Four different production companies. So, do you pick the? I mean, I know you pick yours.
No, I serve as the artistic director, and my role is to help plan the programming.
Okay.
I'll do that one more year, and then we have a new artistic director for 2021. Who will come in and select that slate. We have our slate already picked for 2020. We're already booked into that.
Does the new person know about my 2021 pitch?
Yes.
Okay,
and,
cool.
And what I haven't had a chance to tell Mr. Soucy about, we won't do that here.
Thank you.
We had about a two-hour meeting regarding that very subject right before I arrived here at the radio station.
Cliffhanger.
And so you'll have to stay tuned. But what I want to tell you is the Bard Fest has grown so much that this year we've gotten so much attention that next year we're expanding and offering entirely new projects in addition to our regular slate of shows. And then in 2021, we're going to probably drop Mr. Soucy's little surprise announcement.
Okay.
But we're not going to tell about it now.
No.
Because we don't want to give away the store.
Correct.
So some very, very exciting things are happening for Bard Fest. One of the things also to mention is we've got 50 to 60 of the best actors in town that are playing this stuff. And so the thing that's very exciting about it, even if you're not a Shakespeare fan, is that Falstaff is right in front of you. He's 5 feet away.
Yeah.
Hamlet's right in front of you, and the Tempest. It's very accessible. It's very understandable. You can follow the stories. It's terrific.
I tell people, Shakespeare is a lot like a foreign film where if you're a novice or you don't go to that many, yeah, the first couple of minutes, you might feel like you're in the weeds. But once you and as you said, because we're up close,
right.
You can follow the story even if you're not, you know, if you're not translating the word for word
right.
in your head.
Right.
You're seeing, you know, you're seeing the behaviors, you're seeing the characters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the case of Henry IV, the esteemed director in front of me, which doesn't mean anything for radio. You know, it's kind
actually
of
actually a little to your left.
Fine perfectionist, but it's a little bit of he said it compared to Downton Abbey,
right.
And of course I was a D-bag, and I said, you mean it's parents upstairs, downstairs, it is upstairs, downstairs, where because the film, the play is about not just the kings, but also the common folk,
the regular
in the tavern.
Folks. And see, one of the things, if you think about a show like Downton Abbey, and there's a thousand other examples like this, one of the things that makes the show compelling is you get to see royalty hobnobbing,
yep.
doing royal things, but you also get to see common people going through their trials in life, and people think, well, that's unique idea. No, it's not. Shakespeare
no.
came up with it, and it was with Henry IV that it happened. So you have the trials of Henry the King trying to deal with rebellion and his son, and at the same time you have these wonderfully diverse cast of characters in a tavern who are feeling the effects of what these noble people are doing as they enact policies that affect the entire country. And so that sense of what is best described as correspondence, that communication between the two worlds as you step into one or the other, is what makes it so doggone fun. And so the way we've done it is we've done it in a very cinematic fashion, to borrow your film show, that you just kind of sweep your eyes back and forth, that you step back and forth into the two worlds, and that way it becomes riveting, entertaining.
Yeah.
And we also work in good burp jokes at the same time.
Yeah, there was. Well, I wish I could do one moment on command, but I cannot.
No, don't do that one.
Are you sure?
don't do that one.
Yeah. Well, you also reach an age where you're not sure if that's air or not, and you don't. And you know what? If you see me on the street and you don't understand the section, ask me. I'll tell you.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
But also, I should also mention, since I mentioned upstairs, downstairs, and Downton Abbey, in between there, you have Gosford Park.
Exactly.
Same writer.
Thing.
Robert Altman film. So,
yeah,
go to IndieBardFest.com for
exactly.
the information. You can see two shows in a day on a few. You get some twofers.
I should mention that.
Yes, sir.
If you go to the box office and you want to have a discount, you can buy a four-theater packet, which is
We don't talk about numbers on the show, but
we don't.
There is a deal.
There is a deal available to you,
yeah.
And we don't talk about numbers on
the
show.
Sorry, public radio rules.
Public radio goodness, and we won't do that.
but
there is a deal if you go directly to the box office. It's not mentioned on the
internet. We know you like deals, folks. So, yeah, IndieBardFest.com for all of that. And it's funny because I have on my desk in my office waiting for me, and I was given a gift from Hamlet, Brian Hartz and his lovely wife, Monica. They had sent me a Blu-ray copy of Chimes at Midnight, also known as Falstaff's Greatest Hits, done by Orson Welles. This is a 1966 film. By the way, you're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. Glenn Dobbs knocking his microphone. But also, I guess I'm going back to Henry IV. One of the other things I was given to borrow, which I will watch after the show is done, is the BBC's trilogy of The Royal Crown.
Oh, it's a terrific show.
Yes, yeah. Where you have Ben Whishaw as Richard II.
He's riveting.
You have Henry IV with Tom Hiddleston and Gregory Hines. Jeremy
Part
Irons.
One and part two, which part we don't talk about.
But I will watch part two because there's a part of me there. So anyway, so I'll be watching those when this show is over. Now, I know you recently watched something that is sort of related.
Yeah.
I called it Shakespeare and Angst, but it's also known as All Is True.
Yeah, it was a really interesting piece because it was Kenneth Branagh, Ian McKellen, and Judi Dench. And if you're a Shakespeare fan, it's they're like the holy trinity of Shakespeare actors. And the premise of the story is that in, I believe it's 1623, I'm not quite sure when, Shakespeare's Globe Theater burnt down, and he returned at the age of 50 to 51 to Stratford, and he never wrote another play. We know extremely scant amount about Shakespeare. We have just a few facts that we actually know about the man. And so what this movie does is this movie tries to stitch together about six facts that we know about Shakespeare, and
yes,
it tries to put them into an entire thing.
Right.
For example, we actually have Shakespeare's will. And
the piece of paper where he's going to leave stuff to people,
right?
Not Will himself.
No. We have Shakespeare's will and last will and testament. And you would expect the man who composed King Lear. You would expect the man who composed such soaring rhetoric. You expect his will to reflect that. It's a very common will. The language is very pedestrian. There's nothing particularly spectacular about it. But of note, he left his wife, Anne Hathaway, not the actress, the real Anne Hathaway, his second best bed, which is a really unusual thing to leave somebody. And so the movie takes that fact that we know and builds an entire plot around that.
Mm-hmm.
We know he died on his birthday at age 52. The movie builds an entire plot device about that. Now, here's the interesting thing, and I don't know if you picked up on this. Shakespeare completed his last will and testament, and in the document he writes, "I am of good health," and he died 1 month later.
Right.
And so
it's like getting a vote of confidence.
Yeah, but the thing is of course we know in that particular era, disease, plague, things like that was very common. But you would think that if he was ailing, he would have said something at the time, but he apparently wasn't. The only thing we have of any record of his death is this idea that somebody wrote many years later, there was a night of drinking and he got a fever and died. But no one knows if that's true, substantiated.
It's the Robert Johnson syndrome.
Well, it's apparently kept in a secret server in the White House. You know, I'm sorry, I'm digressing. But here's what was great. We're here to talk about cinema and not get into Shakespeare trivia. All of us have people that we think of or admire or are fans of, Johnny Cash, the movie made about him. And the idea of seeing a behind-the-scenes movie of what these incredible people were like is always intriguing. And if you're a fan of Johnny Cash, then Walk the Line was probably a very, very good movie for you. So the idea that we could pretend that Shakespeare was really Kenneth Branagh back in those days and had that kind of demeanor and poise and stuff is a very compelling thing to watch. So if you're a fanboy, it was great stuff.
It's a low key performance from Branagh.
Yeah,
and he also directed this. Also a very voyeuristic camera. There's not a lot of extreme close-ups. There's no Oscar begging moments in that aspect.
Other than Ian McClellan.
Well, it's Sir Ian, and you get if you get Sir Ian for a little bit of time, but
it's always a pleasure.
Yeah, it's an understated chemistry with him and Judi Dench because they've worked together, they've directed each other for years and years and years, and I jokingly say Shakespeare and Angst because. You know, the only other one that comes to mind of Shakespeare is Shakespeare in Love, and that's
a different movie. Yeah.
It is a different movie. So don't go in expecting to find little clues and little nods and homage. Oh, that's from All's Well That Ends Well, and oh, that's from this, and oh, that's from. I mean, there's a little, but it's not spot the other plays in reference.
And you're the film legend, and I'm not, but because I'm a Shakespeare fan, I always follow Branagh's films,
of course,
And one thing I enjoy about Branagh's films is they're just the cinematography is just lush.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful film to look at. But as he says in the movie, never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
That's kind of like print the legend from The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance.
Exactly, yeah. And so that kind of notion that you hope Shakespeare lived like this, and this is actually what was going on. It's what's fun about watching it, but it's so pretty. The thing that's funny is Anne Hathaway, the real Anne Hathaway.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, for those that are confusing, Anne Hathaway, of course, is an actress. And I don't know if that's her real name or not, but Anne Hathaway was Shakespeare's wife.
Yeah.
Anne Hathaway was 8 years older than Shakespeare when they got married. So at that time, she was kind of a spinster at the time. She was 28 years old when she got married,
mm-hmm.
Likely pregnant. We don't know that for sure. She died 9 years after Shakespeare. But in the movie, Judi Dench plays his wife. Judi Dench is just turned 80, and Kenneth Branagh is 58. So there is a giant difference between them.
So it's a flipped side to the woman who played Cary Grant's mother in North by Northwest, and that actress was younger than Cary Grant.
Right. To Catch a Thief, Grace Kelly was like 18, and Cary Grant was 60, in that movie.
I don't know if she was 18, but
I would... Look
all right,
up.
I will look it
look
up.
It
fine.
Up.
You're all right. All right, go ahead. Keep yammering there.
Yeah, keep yammering. No, but it's so that part was it. But because it's Judi Dench,
yeah.
You kind of don't care, with
mm-hmm.
it. But she was very much old enough to be.
She was 26.
I was close.
How old was
Grant?
Not that. Well, that's this was also in that era where. I think when he said he made Charade with Audrey Hepburn, it was, she has to chase me. I can't chase her.
Yeah.
So, good words to live by, Mr. Grant. I appreciate that.
And circling back all the way back to the beginning of this conversation with Shaft, Samuel Jackson is 70.
And his
wife is
48. Is really not.
Yeah.
There is actually Nathan Rabin, who used to write for... the AV Club. He has a great website, Nathan Raven's Happy Place, and he has a regular column called My World of Flops, and this week was the 2019 Shaft.
Oh, yeah.
And yes, he also brings that up. So, guys run things. I'm sorry. So, yeah, if you're 70 and your leading lady is in her late 40s, I didn't do it.
Yeah.
Sorry. So, All Is True is
it's a lovely movie.
It's a nice little movie.
It's pleasant. It's lovely. It's pretty to look at.
Yep.
And it works in a little bit of Shakespeare that's very accessible.
Yeah.
And you'd like to think that that's what he was like. And nobody knows.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knows anything.
We just learn what we can.
Exactly.
Going back a little bit, where did you grow up?
Oh, I was a military kid. I was born in Oceanside, Camp Pendleton, lived all over the place.
Including?
Oh, you want me to list all of them?
How many?
Oh, it's probably a dozen. Probably the one that's most important is my father retired from the military in New Mexico. I went to a little tiny high school in Moriarty, New Mexico, Go Pintos.
Thank you. The Alumni Association are very excited.
Well, it's because the graduating class was 51.
Ooh.
The school had a lot of money because the governor's daughter also went there.
Ah.
And he was a big cattle rancher. So I went from there. If you know anything about New Mexico, you go through the mountain pass there into Albuquerque, which is half of the population of New Mexico is in Albuquerque. And I went to the University of New Mexico, where I met my lovely wife, Colleen, and that's where we met and dated and got married and went on from there.
Nice. Yeah. So I'm going to guess, since you had to bounce to and fro, were there the single screen movie theaters at least near base or close to base?
My dad was the projectionist at one of the movie theaters, so I got to sit in the projection room and watch movies.
How cinema paradiso of you.
Yeah, very much.
And
so.
What do you remember watching with your dad?
I don't remember a lot of that because I was pretty young at the time, but I do remember the summer of 1977.
Okay, here we go.
You want me to tell that story?
Sure, sure.
I was living in Iran. I was living in Tehran, Iran, before the revolution. I went to my sophomore year of high school there, and my dad was working for a defense contractor over there. And that summer, we went back to coming back home. I knew there wasn't, as many of you obviously are aware, there's no internet, there's no anything like that. And so I remember reading a Time magazine on the plane, because that's all you had to do, and it made this mention that this is a big summer because of movies like Deep Blue, which is sort of the pseudo-sequel to Jaws.
Wait, you mean The Deep?
The Deep. Sorry,
yes, because I remember that because of Jacqueline Bisset.
Yes, yes.
It was a Peter Benchley novel, the guy who did Jaws, but not nearly as good. Although that opening scene with Jacqueline Bisset, guys have that poster.
It's very good. Yeah. But the other one it said in a movie called Star Wars, which I had no idea.
Wasn't also Damnation Alley? I think that was supposed to be 20th Century Fox's big film, because this was a post-apocalyptic thing with George Peppard and Jan Michael Vincent.
Right.
And this was a big budgeted thing that that died.
A big budget back then would have been $1 million.
Well, yeah, but.
So I'm in this plane. I had no idea what Star Wars was. I land in home. I have no idea. And I could see across where I was staying at my uncle's house, I could see that there was a cinema, and it was a twin theater, which is the new thing. Twin theaters. And one of the twin theaters, one was The Deep, and the other was Star Wars. And I thought Star Wars was a kid movie. And so I took my young cousin Dustin and said, let's go to the movie. And thinking it's going to be a cartoon, I get in, and I do remember this absolutely distinctly, that I walked into the movie theater with some popcorn, and the place was absolutely packed. It was filled to the brim. The only seats were in the front row.
Oh.
And so my cousin, who was very small, just happily went down to the front row, and I was regretting this whole thing. And so I was trying to lean back. I was 16 years old. I was trying to lean back and watch it. And this came up, and the scrolling letters and the big thunderous music. And I still think this is kind of dumb. And then that ship comes over, and my cousin says, I have to go to the bathroom. I said, too bad. We're watching the movie. I've never
Here's
seen
a cup. Go for it.
And I don't think I told you this part of the story. My father-in-law passed away 2000. Was an avid sci-fi fan. Loved to go. And he was my partner in all this. And he raved about Star Wars, and his name was Terry. And I said, Terry, why do you like Star Wars so much? And I thought you would appreciate this, and you could use it as one of your quotes. Glenn, you don't understand. Before Star Wars, all we had was Billy Jack. I thought that was a great quote.
You know, it's funny. I actually own the Billy Jack box set.
There you go.
And
there you go.
Yeah, that was, gosh, we had just... also in the AV Club, they have they're doing a regular series on Friday. So they alternate. They do one week, they'll do a column about a noted romantic comedy.
Yeah.
And then the following week, they will do whatever was the top moneymaker of that year and talk about its impact. So they started, I think, 1960. And they're going through, well, last week was Billy Jack.
That was
the big money-making film in 1971.
One Tin Soldier.
Yeah. And,
can you name the band?
Coven.
Yeah, there you
go. With that has an Indiana connection.
Oh, does it? Tell me.
I believe it. Now you're going to make me look that up.
All right.
So, but yeah, I have The Born Losers, Billy Jack, The Trial of Billy Jack, and Billy Jack Goes to Washington. Yes, these were actual films. And they were released on video. I don't believe Billy Jack Goes to Washington ever made it out. I do remember that.
I don't remember that.
Guess what? Take Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and replace Jimmy Stewart with Tom Laughlin. How you doing there? They all have commentary tracks by Tom Laughlin, and guess what? Nobody understood him. It was him versus the world.
That's right.
He is the Pete Rose, Denny McClain, Ike Turner world of that's misunderstood right. people. So,
but you know, I wanted to mention to you, that was such an iconic thing for me to go and such a cultural touchstone. And I took my son to see Avengers Endgame, thinking it would be a similar kind of experience. And it was to a degree. The theater was packed, and when the bad guy got punched in the nose, everyone clapped and cheered and things along that line. But one of the things that the internet has ruined for movies is there's so much of the trailers and the pre-publicity, and so you kind of know what's going to happen before you even go in. Back then, you talked to people about it. You know, there was this word of mouth that built. I remember so clearly when The Empire Strikes Back came out, because back then, as you know, a movie would come to a movie theater and would stay there for six months. They wouldn't change the theater. Mm-hmm. And I remember so clearly there was this line all the way around the building that I'd never seen before. There was one guy wearing what we consider today a very cheap version, but he was wearing a Darth Vader outfit, and everybody wanted their picture taken with him.
Sure.
And when he said in that movie theater, "I am your father, Luke," everybody went nuts.
Of course.
You know, with it. But you just don't have that as much today. And although he's a younger, my son's younger, I don't know if he'll look back on that. Avengers Endgame was a huge movie. I don't know if you look back and think of it as the same touchstone.
No. You know what? You know what also doesn't help?
What?
Putting out 20 Marvel films in 10 years.
Well, I think that's great.
I know it is. In fact, I am going to share this. I shared this with Glenn earlier, and I'm going to share it with you. This is a clip from the Rich Hall documentary, Continental Drifters, from the BBC.
Artistic integrity at
How's
the time.
How's cheesecake, hon?
It's not that... You know, everything else was fine.
I'll take this one back.
No, I'll tell you why. Let's say that it really was good cheesecake. Let's say that it became the most popular thing on the menu. That the only reason people came here was for the cheesecake, right? They don't want the network burger or the taxi driver omelet or the French Connection soup. They just want cheesecake. And then they start telling all their friends and neighbors, oh, you got to go to the Livingston truck stop. The cheesecake is out of this world. It's like something from a planet a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. And then pretty soon, that's all anybody would want. They wouldn't care about taste anymore, would they, sir? They just want this stodgy, lumpy piece of caulking compound passing itself off as cheesecake. And then pretty soon, the diner turns into this big money-sucking franchise selling cheesecake action figures and cheesecake lightsabers, plundering clients for generations to come. And then, one day, the diner announces it's coming out with a sequel to the cheesecake. And everyone flocks here to see the new, improved version of the cheesecake. And then the waitress walks up with a big bowl of egg yolks and says, "Here you go, sir. Here's some egg yolks. Here's some vanilla extract. Here's some cream cheese. These are all the things that made up the cheesecake before it was cheesecake." And they do this not once, but three times. Three times. And people don't care. They come here for the cheesecake anyway because they've forgotten there was a time when there was something on the planet besides cheesecake. And that is how George Lucas screwed up American cinema.
He's crabbier than I am.
Yes.
So that
but
is.
You know, I think. I heard that when you sent that to me, and I do have an alternative viewpoint to that.
Go right ahead.
I certainly appreciate, as a person who does a lot of theater, I certainly appreciate that if I just did Neil Simon all the time, even though Neil Simon sells a lot of tickets,
right?
That I would limit myself to the vast scope of range of theater and. And I think the fact that Marvel sucks up all the movie dollars in the world right now is fine. But if you look at it, if you're a fan, and you don't look at an individual movie, but you look at it as a long, mythical epic that all of it's connected. It's like the Iliad, and that you see all of these particular pieces connected together. You enjoy it because you want to see Thor, what happens to him as time goes by. And that part, if you're a fan, you enjoy a great deal. I agree with you. It's not a standalone. It's very formulaic, and it's not a standalone like that by itself can live forever as a movie picture.
Right.
But if you put all of it together, it's terrific. One of the things that, and I'd be curious of your opinion of this, one of the things that differs between Star Wars and the Marvel movies is Star Wars, like the cheesecake thing, said, well, we're just going to make money like crazy. And they started putting out a lot of every kind of twist in the world of, I mean, if you really think about it, the George Lucas story is a really thin story. There's not a lot in there.
Mm.
And so they put out every single kind of twist on that in the world just to break in cash. And people began to sense that, which is why the Solo movie didn't do well, et cetera,
right,
as it goes through. The Marvel movie at least tries to say, okay, we're going to try to stay true to the original source material. We're going to try to go. And the original source material is a comic book, so it's not Hamlet.
You know what? They're not splitting Hamlet into two films either.
Right. So I think I appreciate that particular part. But you're right. Have you seen the Kenner Toy documentary about Star Wars?
I have not.
You really should watch that,
okay,
because it's fascinating in terms of how they even came up with the whole concept of making money on toys.
Oh, yeah.
And
And this is when, and of course, and Star Wars wasn't the first blockbuster. Jaws before that, The Exorcist before that. This set the business template.
I'm going to show you how bad I was about Jaws. We went to see Jaws, and I was living in Texas. That's one of the rotations.
Uh-huh.
I was living in Texas, not near the coast in Texas.
Nope.
And my dad was obsessed with going out camping in this very small trailer camp thing. And lakes in Texas, if you haven't been there, are awful. They're utterly devoid of trees. They look like a big mud pit in the ground. And if you don't enjoy water skiing, they're miserable experiences. It's like try to imagine if Venus had a lake. You know,
okay.
Venus had like that. That's what it was like. So I remember we went to see Jaws the night before, and I opened the curtain to the little tiny camper, and I looked out on the lake. And my dad said, you can go swimming. I ain't getting in that water because there might be a shark.
Well, you know?
And I was dead serious. I was so anxious after watching that movie with it. Everyone was scared to death after that thing.
Well, I was younger than you. Well, I still am. But I was younger than you when I saw Star Wars in 77. We had the Flint Cinema on Dort Highway, if I remember. I believe that's where I saw the movie. But it was the theater with the largest screen.
Right.
We had a four-screener at the Genesee Valley, which might have also shown it as well. There was a two-screener in a mall. We had our drive-in. Mm-hmm. And then the Flint Cinema, and in the Capitol downtown, which that's another story for another time. So it was a big deal by the late 70s when the six-screen multiplex opened in Burton. Anyway, but it hit me at the right moment. I was seven when Star Wars came out.
Right.
Perfect timing. And that meant I was, what, nine when Empire...
God, am I that much older than you
were? No, you look fine. 13 when Empire came out.
Yeah.
And by then, my tastes were started. And, of course, to quote Kevin Smith, all Jedi was a bunch of Muppets. Mm. And so then the three, as we heard Rich Hall yammer about.
Right.
So it's really hard to connect. It's really hard to match the seven-year-old in me. So when I went and saw... I think it was Jedi, Last Jedi.
Was it Jedi or Force Awakens?
Either one. But it was seeing guys my age with their seven-year-old
right.
son. And this was going to be their experience. And so I can't yuck their yum on that.
Yeah.
And as I've talked before on and off air about the Marvel films, individually are good, range from excellent to good. It's just when it feels like a chore, and the fact that there's so many so quickly.
Right.
And you're talking to a James Bond freak, but James Bond has 26 films in the span of almost 60 years,
right,
as opposed to the flux.
With the Disney Plus coming out, it's going to get worse.
Yeah, it's going to get worse. So I'm going to get you. So I will be older and crabbier and all that. And
I
now I'm the guy.
That.
What if you enjoy Star Wars, of course, you should watch The Hidden Fortress, Kurosawa's
yeah.
film. So,
yeah.
And I'll get to these documentaries in a little bit. So Jaws, 1975, Long Beach Island, New Jersey, with my father. My grandfather, who I thought was the old man in the sea, walked out. And then the next day, we went to the beach. And my father, a fellow doctor, lifted me over his head, hummed two notes, and walked toward the water. Scared the living hell out of me. Five years old.
Yeah.
And so that's the power of cinema, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
So you've heard two of those things that happened there. My cousin was stationed in Hawaii for a while, and I think of that as the single screen movie theater that's located on base. I remember they were showing, I believe, Peter Bogdanovich's They All Laughed. Right. That sort of thing. So
back when the popcorn was real.
When the popcorn was real. So what you heard earlier was Rich Hall of Saturday Night Live and not necessarily the news fame. He is the reason, folks, that I have not watched Ken Burns' Country Music Saga yet, because I came across
these. It's marvelous.
I know. And I will watch it, and I can't wait to watch it. It has been great to hear people online and on the street say, I don't like country music. Or this is the stuff my parents or my grandparents had to listen, you know, made me listen to, and they enjoy it because, you know, Ken Burns is that kind of guy. In the early aughts or in the early teens or in the 20 teens, Rich Hall did a series of documentaries for the BBC, which I highly recommend. One is called California Stars. You heard the one I just played for you was from one called Continental Drifters. This was about not only the history of the road picture, but it also paralleled the auto industry as well as the rise of the American highway system. So it covers, I mean, all the way back to The Wizard of Oz to Thelma and Louise and everything in between. They talk about the Grapes of Wrath. They talk about Vanishing Point. They talk about Paris, Texas. Alice doesn't live here anymore. In fact, Rich Hall just talked about Alice doesn't live here anymore when he's doing his little spot in a diner, and that led to that rant. Hall's very opinionated, obviously, in this case. He also has one called How the West Was Lost, which talks about the American Western. The Dirty South, which talks about the image of the South in popular culture and movies and how that has sort of changed, kind of changed. Anyway, these are really, and these are, I had no idea these existed until, I guess, thanks YouTube, you Orwellian website, you. There's also one called Inventing the Indian, which is about the image of Native Americans.
Sure.
Thanks, that in parallel pop culture. So if you have finished country music, look for Rich Hall on YouTube.
Yeah.
So this is really, really good stuff. I remember my father was also, as I mentioned, also a doctor, and he would take me to stuff with him. I mean, I saw the kid stuff in the 70s, which, by the way, looking back, not the best time in the world. Disney was at a fairly low area. There were a number of odd
the land before time.
No, before that, this was when Bob Crane starred in a Disney film called Super Dad, and it was put on the shelf for a couple of years because Bob Crane's lifestyle wasn't that great. And I still make jokes about doing the commentary track for the Bob Crane box set, know what I mean.
They never found who killed him, did they?
Nope.
Yeah.
No, they did not. And Autofocus, the Paul Schrader film with Greg Kinnear, that's my favorite Greg Kinnear film and my favorite Greg Kinnear performance. And I will tell the story now that I brought it up. Vicariously through me, made Greg Kinnear laugh on Indie Style TV. So every now and then I pop up on Indie Style and I get to hang out with my old TV buddy, Tracy Foreigner. And Tracy was always really good about telling me who he was going to be interviewing via, you know, the Skype or the big screen that they have on those TV shows. And he told me he was interviewing Greg Kinnear. Greg was doing one of the he's starting to do some of the kind of spiritual feel good movies, you know, as the token big name. Mm-hmm. And I said to Tracy, I said, my favorite Greg Kinnear performance is Autofocus. Mm-hmm. And they should make a musical out of that. Tracy told Greg that.
And what did he say?
He cracked up. He just said, we have a movie critic on earlier who said his favorite film of yours is Autofocus when you're making it into a musical. And he just buried his face in his hands and started laughing. So so imagine it from Greg Kinnear's point of view. He's in a hotel room in New York or L.A. or Chicago. And then you'll be talking to Tracy Foreigner from Mindy Style in Indianapolis and answering the same questions and talking the same thing about the movies. And then somebody put that warped idea in his head. And that was me. So thank you, Tracy.
Thank you, Greg. There you go.
Anyway, so the movie, the kids' films of the 70s, so yet the Peanut films are probably the best, but Disney was down. There were a number, I found out through television and through theater that there were a number of animated films for adults, and I don't mean Fritz the Cat, although that's an obvious choice. But Ralph Bashke also did Wizards and Lord of the Rings. There was also The Mouse and His Child and Raggedy Ann and Andy, which was there was Watership Down, and there was Fantastic Planet. Just a weird, weird era for animated. And, this was not stuff I was watching on Saturday morning. So, but anyway, my father was really good at taking me to movies, but I think he also wanted to see stuff he wanted to watch.
Oh, sure.
So, you tag along, and there is that kind of special feeling that you're going to see stuff that the kids aren't supposed to see. You're going to movies with the grown-ups. By the way, we say grown-up movies. We don't say adult movies. That's a completely different connotation. Don't want CPS coming after you. But, Dad took me to the college movies. That's where I saw Woody Allen for the first time. Yeah. I saw the Marx Brothers. He showed me – I remember seeing King of Hearts. Mm-hmm. When we first bought our – we were the first one in the neighborhood to have the giant 800-pound top-loading Betamax. Who knew? And the first movie my father bought was Harold and Maude.
Oh, my.
Which was my introduction to dark comedy. Explains a lot.
Yes.
So I don't know
why you make those choices as Falstaff. Yeah.
I am eternally grateful for my dad saying, I don't want to see kid stuff. I want to see stuff I see. And talking to me, you talk your kid through it as best you can. You try to explain to him why Fredo isn't the smartest one and why Sonny had to die and why Michael takes over even though he doesn't want to take over the business. But, parental guidance suggested. I had parental guidance.
Right.
So anyway, I was very, very lucky on that. Do you remember your first date movie with your lovely wife? This is not the Newlywed Game, I assure you.
Oh, my. Now you're testing me. We've been married...
how many years?
36 years.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so I don't know if I remember the first date movie. I don't remember.
You know, when you come back on the show in a couple... There's your homework assignment. I'm still looking up Scutcheson. Don't worry, I'll get to that.
I actually know what
that is. I have not forgotten. Yes, folks, research.
You've got me there. She doesn't like movies as much as I do. We usually, when we go on dates, we wouldn't go to movies. I'll tell you the one thing that she'll tell you about that I really screwed up at.
Go on.
The second Aliens came out.
And the James Cameron one.
Yeah, being a sci-fi, of course, it was the big hit movie in town, and everybody wanted to go see it. And my son had just gotten born, and he was about 4 or 5 months. And so I reasoned that if we could go and sit in the back row. I did this.
It got
worse.
No.
I reasoned if I go sit in the back row, and my wife was breastfeeding.
Quick.
I thought this was just perfect. And so we sat in the back row and thinking that if he was fine, we could watch the movie. And I talked her into doing that.
Oh.
And
you were that parent.
Oh, yeah, I very much was. So we went there, and the first giant music came on, and he immediately started crying.
Nope.
And my wife very wisely just handed him to me and said, enjoy your time in the lobby.
Yep.
And I was out there in the lobby the entire time.
Wow.
And then asked her what happened, and she stayed for the movie.
Did she like it, though?
She's not a big horror movie fan. She likes historical dramas. She likes... the romantic comedies, things along that line. So she doesn't really like to go to a lot of them.
Right.
So I can't remember exactly which one that.
Okay.
I have to ask her.
That's
fine.
That's all right.
How about you?
The first one Lynn and I saw, and because I let her pick. I knew because she.
Oh,
she,
yeah. I always let her pick.
Yeah. She knew that, you know, film nerd guy here, very opinionated and stuff. So I had her pick, no matter what it was going to be. And she picked the film version of To Jillian on her 37th birthday.
Okay. That's
based,
weird.
Based on. No, because it was a play that she knew of.
Oh, yeah.
This is Peter Gallagher as a widower, and it's his first year out on the beach in the summer. They have a summer home.
Mr. Eyebrows
with his daughter played by Claire Danes and his dead wife played by Michelle Pfeiffer. Now, Mrs. Soce knows my feelings about Michelle Pfeiffer, and I said in the movie theater, I said, you're all right with this. And she said, basically, the movie's going to be over 2 hours. I'm still going to be here. So, yeah, I had her pick that. How do we even compare it to? But anyway, he has conversations with his wife's ghost while he's trying to move forward, and everybody else in his family is trying to have him move forward. Yeah. So it's a nice first date film.
I do have a movie story with my wife. Again, back to my first son. My wife really wanted to see Ghost.
Okay, 1990. Yep.
Yeah, and so, you know, I was in residency and I didn't have a lot of time to go see movies. And she would direct me every day to come home to go by the movie rental place. And back then, as you well know, they would have about 10 new releases, and it could be weeks before somebody would allow you to get it.
Oh, yeah. And you had to fight for these folks. Sometimes make multiple trips, and sometimes, you know, and if you knew the guy, you might slip him a couple bucks and go, hey, when it comes in, can you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So every day home from the hospital, where I was working, I would swing into the video store, and finally I got it. And I went home. I said, I've got it. And she was very pregnant at that time and due any day. And I remember I set her up in the rocking chair and got her all comfortable. Mm-hmm. And I made up for my aliens thing. Well, actually, that was later. That was later. So
wishful thinking.
And got her all set up, and we put it in and made the popcorn and got it ready for her. She was so excited to see this movie because she had heard so much about it.
Right.
Got about 10 minutes into it, her water broke, and we had the baby.
And how long before you watched it again?
Oh, it was like 2-3 years later before we ever got back to it.
Was she afraid? She wasn't afraid it was going to
do
something.
No. The movie didn't make her water break. It just happened.
She
says, I think we got to go into labor because nothing had happened yet in the movie. And so we went and did that. Yeah, I remember that. I remember seeing, I think it might have been Footloose.
1984?
Yeah, it's been that long ago. We got married in 1984, so it might have been Footloose.
The lobby thing, like Emma was 4 when she went and saw her first film with Dad, and then I had to review.
Was it the Night of the Zombies or something?
No, it was Racing Stripes. This was a zebra that wanted to be a racehorse, and you know, like Frankie Muniz was one of the voices, and Dustin Hoffman and Whoopi Goldberg, and it was one of those where I was going to take her. I had to review it for you know, show purposes, radio purposes. And I knew going in, kind of like Heat, I knew I was going to have to, if I had to leave in a moment's notice, I was not going to get my money back, any of that stuff. Mm-hmm. And she made it through the film. Mm-hmm. So then I started taking her to stuff, but there was one, I took Lynn and Emma to see March of the Penguins, and I had to review it. And Emma was just
a dull movie.
No, it's fine. I thought, well, the penguins will keep her occupied. Yeah. And she was just in a fussy mood. And Lynn and her spent time in the lobby while I.
Oh, well, you were working.
I was working.
You were
so
working.
That was,
so
that
you
was
need to go to the lobby.
That's that.
Would you bring me some popcorn back?
No, I didn't ask that because then I get sitcom wife look, and nobody wants that. So yeah, there was that. I always tell new fathers and mothers, I'm like, you can watch anything the first year. Emma still has yet to bring up the Wild Bunch.
Yeah.
So, you know, there was the moment where, because I was the guy, whatever's at the top of my pile, I'm watching it. No matter what, I'm old and crusty and what have you. Mm-hmm. And Emma was about 2. And in our old house, I could see her in the kitchen. She was in her little play saucer. And, you know, I could hear her playing, and so I knew she was going to be fine. I had a movie on. Emma was not in the room with me watching this movie. She was in the kitchen with her play circle. And Lynn came home and saw the movie. And she had heard me say this for a long time of, I can watch anything in the first year. It's fine. Well, this was age two. And Lynn came home. And it was not even a questionable scene. But she recognized that I was watching The Exorcist. And she picked up Emma over her shoulder.
You were on my case about aliens?
Yeah, going up the stairs. And, of course, I finally went, all right, okay, I will start. I will start watching what films of you know, what I will be watching when she is awake. So, yeah, I did that.
Well,
I did that. I know. Yeah. Now, it's funny. My dad was a surgeon. So anytime we had... He was off, you know, not on call or got out early or what have you. Like, I remember we had a two-screen cinema in Grand Blanc, which is a suburb of Flint. And they were showing Kurosawa's Kagamusha, which Siskel and Ebert had raved about because we watched sneak previews religiously on Thursdays on Channel 20, University of Michigan, Flint. And the fact that a Kurosawa film was coming to Flint, we didn't have to drive down to the Art House Theater in Detroit to see it. And this was my first Kurosawa film. And it basically, a commoner is hired to pose as the emperor, and Kurosawa things happen. And it was 1980, and, you know, Dad was very excited, and we went and saw the theater. And within 5 minutes, he was asleep. Dad fell asleep in the theater. So sometimes he paid to nap. The change was he also liked the action movies, and he also liked, you know, the Marx Brothers stuff that I had mentioned before, and he's the one who introduced me to Woody Allen. But I remember 1989, I really, really wanted to see My Left Foot.
Oh, yeah.
And my father finally, it was the first time I'd heard him say, son, I'm around that all day at work. I don't want to go home and see it.
No, that's true.
And now, but on the flip side, if we watch Chuck Norris and Steven Seagal, he would tell me how to fix, you know, Chuck would snap somebody's arm in, you know, three places and say, well, you need to do this and you need to do that.
Was he an orthopedist?
He was a vascular, so he was a DO, vascular surgeon. So, but he still did, you know, whenever possible. But, yeah, you know, one of his favorite films is Paddy Chayefsky's The Hospital, which was one of my other early dark comedies.
Is that the
George C. Scott and Diana Rigg?
Yeah.
Still holds up, folk. It's 1971. It's still pretty good.
Yeah,
so.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, that's kind of – and I think I've taken my father's practice and passed it on to my daughter, who likes everything from Hamlet to Bachelor Party, as I mentioned. Going back to Brana, I remember seeing his Hamlet in Chicago with my lovely wife, and it was the only time I ever purchased tickets for a movie over the phone.
Oh, I thought you meant the stage play.
No. The film, the 1996, where he decided to film the entire play with half the Screen Actors Guild involved.
Right.
And yeah, I to borrow a line from Dennis Miller, I'm not on the phone this long with friends contemplating suicide. And got the tickets, and there were rock concerts easier to get in and out of because people ran to seats and claimed them. And, sure. You know, the only thing missing were beach balls and lighters when the screens went down. But, you know, there was a roar of cheering getting ready for that film.
It's a beautiful movie, but you got to be a fan.
Oh, you have to be a serious fan. And so, like, when my lovely wife played the most beautiful Gertrude ever at IRT, and Emma was six, I fast-forward through a lot of that. We got through his Hamlet in 2.5 hours. So basically any scene with Gertrude. So any scene with, you know, anytime Julie Christie came on, Emma would go, Mummy. And went, well, not quite. It's different. And we get to the duel. And our daughter says, Daddy, yeah, this isn't going to end good. And so I call Lynn's in rehearsal. She kept this in her voicemail for months. And you can hear the movie in the background. And I said, honey, our child has something to say to you. And I hand her the phone. She's like, Mommy, you are about to die. You're going to die right now. Okay, love you. Bye. And hang up the phone. So, yeah, that's a little bit of raising your kids through Shakespeare in one way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
What was funny about when Lynn and I were courting, I like saying courting, it sounds literature.
Sounds elegant.
Yeah, it sounds elegant. But this is a visual aid, so you have to look it up online. But I call it the MasterCard logo because there's her taste and then there's my taste. Mm-hmm. And somewhere in between is a big – and sure. Actually, the only other person I do that with is Abdul. Because Abdul and I, when we first met, we learned very quickly a mutual love of Richard Pryor, Monty Python, Svengoolie, musicals.
Sure.
You know, we found a really good foundation right in the center. And I made Lynn watch us a lot of nonsense when we were dating.
Did you like, speaking of musicals, did you like Branagh's musical
Love's Labor's Lost? Yeah. I'm so glad you brought that
up.
Well,
you gave me a piece of paper to ask you.
I did, yes. So, yes, if for the lack of editing that Branagh did in Hamlet, he makes up for it in his Love's Labor's Lost, which he made into a Cole Porter musical.
Right.
With him and Natasha Lyonne and Adrian Lester and Matthew Lillard and Alicia Silverstone,
and Nathan Lane,
Timothy Spall, and you know, and even if you don't agree with the choices, you have to give him props for sheer onions to make that into Love's Labor's Lost. And the thing it also has, which I have praised highly, is that there are different degrees of vocal ability.
Oh, yeah.
So it makes not everybody sounds like the greatest singer in the world, which has been what the musical has done since movie musicals came into existence. It hasn't been until, it didn't work in the late 60s when you cast movie stars that could sort of sing or less. And now you have some musicals where there are various degrees of vocal ability. Everybody Says I Love You, Love's Labor's Lost, Mamma Mia, and yeah, your favorite, La La Land. So that humanizes the movie musical. I think is very, very important.
You know, Renee Zellweger is supposed to sing her own stuff in Judy Garland.
I have not checked on that yet, so I'm intrigued.
It's actually her voice.
Okay, yeah. So I can't wait to hear that. Yeah. Of course, the kid in Rocket Man did his own vocals, and then on the flip side,
he's done musicals. He's got musical theater background.
Right. Yeah. And actually what helped get him that gig was he did one of Elton John's songs in an animated film called Sing.
Right.
Did I'm Still Standing. So, you know, there are people that can do great singing performances, and there are those that can lip sync really, really well, right. Like Jessica Lange in Sweet Dreams, mm-hmm. as playing
Hepburn.
Patsy Cline. Audrey Hepburn twice. Well, no, I shouldn't say that. Audrey Hepburn once. Marnie Nixon dubbed two people famously in West Side Story, and My Fair Lady did the vocals for Natalie Wood as well. So yeah, there are parallels of those. But as somebody who now finds Pierce Brosnan as a vocal influence, I'm on pro sing how you sing, even if you can't sing that well. I also like Keith Richards songs, so that's just.
Like Keith Richards songs.
Well, yeah. Some folks don't, but I also enjoy the works of Bob Dylan and Neil Young. And no, I don't do Bob Dylan can't sing jokes in 2019. It is the airplane food and in-laws of music humor.
There's a great story about Bob Dylan that I read the other day. I read recently.
He was
touring, and he got to a particular location, and for reasons known only to Bob Dylan. He decided to go for a walk.
Sure.
And there was a neighborhood near where he was. And, you know, he's not the most normal-looking fellow. And he's just walking down the street, and some neighbor called the police, saying there's a strange guy walking down the street,
a vagrant.
Police show up. It's a young man. He says, can I see some identification? He goes, I don't have any identification. He says, well, what's your name? Bob.
And
so he says, well, you're going to need to come with me so I can get you relocated. He puts him in the police car, and an older police officer comes and says, you've got Bob Dylan in your police car. And he goes, oh, my God. He says, Mr. Dylan, can we give you a ride to the concert? That's a great story.
Wow. Yeah. Nice. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeesh. All right. So, ladies and gentlemen, how you doing, Glenn?
I'm great.
Cool.
This has been a good time.
I
really appreciate
it.
The chance to come in and chat with you.
Good. So, just a reminder, folks, Indie Bard Fest is happening October 17th through the 27th. You can go to IndieBardFest.com for all the information. You have Lear Shadow, you have The Tempest, Hamlet, and that thing known as Henry the Fourth, Part One.
Don't
with yours
miss
truly.
Matthew Soucy in that role. It's definitely something that you'll be talked about in a very positive way.
Come for the stay. Come for me, stay for the show.
And if you ever wondered what Matthew Soucy actually looks like, with it and just not that wonderfully warm radio voice that he has, come and see him.
Gosh,
He looks just like Pierce Brosnan.
Will you stop? No, I always say it's Wolfman Jack meets Ryan Gosling. But that's,
there you go.
That's all right.
There you
no,
go.
Okay. I will. I did a couple musicals a couple years ago. Mm. So
you were in Fiddler on the Roof. Right?
I was in Fiddler on the Roof at Richmond Civic Theater. I played the rabbi. But prior to that, so I had in high school, we had a choir director. Loved by many, not by me, not a nice guy. And I was told to lip sync when we were doing the Crapshooters Ballet from Guys and Dolls. Mm. And this was before Milli Vanilli, and I kind of took that as a personal insult.
Oh.
And that kind of did some damage in my head when it came to singing. Yeah, well, you know, I'm 17.
Childhood trauma.
Teenhood trauma.
Teenhood trauma.
I'm fine, folks. You know, I wound up auditioning for summer stock theater in college, and that didn't happen. And then Richmond Civic did Spamalot. Mm. And I thought, well, I love Monty Python, and that stuff's not that hard.
Harder than you think.
Well, as I found out. But and I thought, well, I hadn't auditioned for a musical in probably over 20 years. Mm-hmm. So,
did you go sing Amazing Grace at the audition?
I did not. No, but what happened was we did some moves. I shuffled as best I could. And then I sang He's Not Quite Dead, which is from the show. Mm-hmm. And I felt good. I was having a fun time.
Yeah.
I had fun, you know, clod hopping, and then I sang with some confidence. It may not have been the best, but I felt good. And at the end of my song, I bellowed that Pierce Brosnan could kiss my something, and which got a big laugh. I didn't get cast in the show, but that's okay because the other part was I was not available for the first month of rehearsals because I was directing. I had a paid gig as a director, but I established myself with this director.
Sure.
I had a fun time. I got to meet some people. And then, a few years later, they were doing Fiddler on the Roof, and I had a beard, and I was male. So I had a shot. But I was also doing your show. Mm. I was doing Richard III. Mm-hmm. So I knew I wasn't going to get Tevye, but I got the rabbi, and the rabbi was fun, and my daughter was in the chorus, and we got to sing together. And I eventually had to tell my choreographer, can we agree that the rabbi cannot dance well because he's got other priorities? And she said, sure. And that was a big relief.
Sure.
And so we had fun doing that. And then a couple months later, Emma and I did Peter and the Star Catcher together. What also helped on that song, because I had a small duet, but I had to sing in character voice.
Mm.
So, but it was fine. I was doing this kind of gruff Cockney Sea Dog thing, so I didn't have to actually use my quote unquote singing voice. Mm. And that was also kind of a big relief,
sure,
compared to everything else. So, yeah, but yeah, I was one of those. Yes, I made fun of the men in Mamma Mia and Pierce can't sing and blah 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 blah. But I also thought it also takes serious stones to have that captured on film forever.
Or a big paycheck.
And that's the thing. You don't turn down that job. Your agent says, okay, I got good news for you. You're going to do a movie with Meryl Streep, right, and you're shooting it in the south of Greece.
Sure.
Oh, by the way,
it's a musical.
It's an ABBA musical. It's kind of like, and we will wrap up with this other part where I say, I don't blame him for taking the job, even if nobody liked it, but Keanu Reeves in Much Ado About Nothing. Well, you get to be in a movie with Ken and Emma and the rest of the gang, and you get to live in the south of Italy for a summer and do Shakespeare. You also get a weird massage in leather pants, but other, you know, and scowl, but you don't turn down that job.
No.
You just don't. So you cannot like it or like it, but you don't turn down that job.
Exactly.
So, all right, ladies and gentlemen, here's some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Have you watched Soylent Green and Zardoz?
Yeah.
Somebody in our show had a Zardoz shirt. I'm very, very jealous. So I'll have to work on that. Anyway, IndieBardFest.com for all the information. Glenn, we'll be seeing you here in a couple weeks because we will have the film
More
sociology,
the
BardFest roundtable,
exactly.
as we like to have. So I'm glad we got to do some non-Shakespeare stuff with
you. Oh, absolutely. It was a lot of fun. I really appreciate you asking me.
My pleasure. Thank you. And I'll see you in rehearsal. Go see a good movie. You deserve it. And, of course, Indie BardFest is coming up. And thank you for supporting public radio goodness here at WFYI. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film talk show here on WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!